and also 9-2 on RF channel 44. And then on channel RF channel 38, I can get 9-1 and 5-2. So they're probably simulcasting everything on both RF channels. That's what I'm thinking.
That's exactly right. You can make the converter say whatever you want it to say. And Fox, which owns both stations, chose to keep their branding the same, even though they're on two different RF channels.
So he's getting that on a Zenith converter. I'm getting it on a Radio Shack converter. I get this split channel characteristic between 5-1 and 5-2 is what the converter is telling us on both the Radio Shack and the Zenith. Whatever number gets plugged in there, you know, during the scan operation is when that number got plugged in. So what's your guess as to how the wrong brand number versus channel number got plugged in during the scanning process for Zenith and the scanning process for Radio Shack? What's your guess as to how the converter started making those errors, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Okay. Let's start at the beginning. The five major channel on one screen. Okay, so actually I haven't watched Fox lately to see what they're doing. Originally how they set it up, they may, because of all the confusion, decided to change the numbers. So what you're saying is that 5-1 and 9-2 are on channel 44, which is entirely doable, and that 9-1 and 5-2 are on channel 38, they may have changed what they're putting in the stream. Originally, when they set it up, it was 5-1 was NYW and 5-2 was WWOR. Maybe they decided that because people were so confused, they were going to change what the stream says, right? That's possible. In that aspect of it, I could be wrong. But they're both coming from the same stream. So that would make what you're saying correct in terms of sometimes you can get 5-1, but you can't get 5-2 because one of them's on 44, one of them's on 38. Originally, for the past couple of years, 5-1 and 5-2 were 44, and 9-1 and 9-2 were 38. So I'll give you the fact that maybe they changed the nomenclature, but out of transmitter number one, which is Fox, is coming 5-1 and 9-2. I'll give you that. They're both on 44. All right? But they're the same stream. That's the whole point.
Okay. If I reassemble what I think you're saying now, are you saying that there is a possibility that when I watch 5-1, I'm watching RF channel 44, when I watch 5-2, I'm watching RF channel 38? I think you're saying there is the possibility that the Zenith converter and the Radio Shack converter giving those pieces of information might be telling the truth. Is that what you're saying, Eric?
Yeah, well, I'm looking at it now, and I've got 5-1 as WNYWDTV, and I've got 5-2 as WWORDT. So, maybe what I'll do is rescan my converter and see if it comes up with anything different.
Is there a way that when you're doing this testing process you're doing right now, you know what RF channel number is being looked at when you're at 5-1 and 5-2 brand numbers? Go ahead.
Okay, I'll hear me. When I go to work on, when I get back to the station on Tuesday, I will put the stream analyzer on it and see if they change the PSIP numbers, which is entirely possible. Something tells me I don't think so, but it's entirely possible. And what that would mean is that what you're calling 5-1 and 9-2 are on channel 44. And what you're calling 9-1 and 5-2 are on channel 38. That's entirely possible, Again, I could make either one of those streams say whatever the heck I want.
And it's possible, I think you're saying, that the PSIP setup on those data streams are indicating that particular combination. That's what I think you're saying, Eric. Go ahead.
Well, that would be new, or at least it would be new to me, because I don't usually watch those channels. And let's see what this has to say. Well, my converter stands still saying 9-1, 9-2. They're the same RF frequency. So, let me look at the stream analyzer and see what the PSIPs have to say about it. And then I will tell you next week whether or not what the actual facts are. But all I can say is it hasn't been that way, but then again, I haven't looked in a couple months, so I don't know for sure. But generally, most of the rest of the world will not do something like that.
Hey, WB2AZQ for a quick comment.
Yeah, very fine, Tony. Stand by for a second. There was something else I want to mention to Eric. You speculated, Eric, that when I go to 5-1 and I get it and don't get 5-2, that I'm close to the threshold on the 2. There are times when 5-1 will give me a bar chart amplitude, apparent error of 75, at the same time that 5-2 is giving me 20, and I'm not getting it, and vice versa. So I can get some apparent large differences between the two. That gives me reasonably strong confirmation that they really are on different RF channel numbers. But that's, again, a piece of evidence, not a proof. Mr. AZQ, go right ahead, Tony. What measurements have you made along these lines?
I get them both very strong, but with the Zenith, I can watch 5-1 and then bring up the menu and go into the manual RF tune mode. And when I, on 5-1, it shows RF channel 44. And then when I get out of the menu and go up to 5-2, and go back into the menu and go to the RF channel, it tells me it's on 38. That's what the Zenith converter is showing me. Go ahead.
Tom, what does it say when you go to 9-1 and 9-2?
Basically the same thing. 38 is 9-1 and 44 is 9-2.
I get the same thing on a Radio Shack converter. Back to you, Eric.
Okay, they obviously changed the PSIPs. So now you can see that 5-1 and 9-2, even though it says that, is channel 44, and 9-1 and 5-2 is channel 38. So they changed the labeling. I'm sorry.
Eric, is that the first mistake you might have ever made? I'm having some fun with you.
Yeah, I'm waiting for a beep. In terms of this, yeah, because I haven't kept aware of what Fox is doing. They obviously decided that it was confusing people too much.
I'm a little bit curious as to how this method of setup is less confusing compared to what else they could have done, Eric, go ahead.
I wonder where my beep went. Well, the fact that they have HD on 5-1 and SD on 9-2 and HD on 9-1 and SD on 9-2, why did they do that in the first place? Whereas they could actually be putting something completely different on. Whereas if you look at, say, 7-1 is HD, 7-2 is whatever they call it, and 7-3 is the weather. Well, 4-1 is NBC, and 4-2 is whatever they call it, and 4-3 is Universal Sports, you know. For the same token, 13-1 is 13 HD, 13-2 is 13 kids, and 13-3 is VME. And, of course, 21-1 is WLIW, 21-2 is Create, and 21-3 is World. So each one of those are all on the same RF channel, except for Fox. They have to be different.
Yeah, one other crazy thing is that 4-1 is NBC, 4-2 is New York All the Time or whatever, and then they skip to 4-4 for the sports channel. There appears to be no 4-3 on branding. Back to you, Eric.
Yeah, it's whatever number they stick in the table. If you go to, 17? I think you get like 6 or 8 channels. You get a couple of audios. You get the weather channel. You know, you get NOAA. You get a whole bunch of stuff. And it's all a matter of how much you want to stuff into 19.39 megabits worth of space.
When you said that's on 17, that's brand 17 or real RF channel 17?
It's real RF channel. It's 17, I think. It's either 17 or 18. I'll tell you in a second. I'll take a look. It's, let's see, it's 11, 21, it's 17.
Where is 17 coming from, Eric? Is that Connecticut?
No, it's coming from the 81st floor of the Empire State Building.
Oh-ho. Which channels of New York City are not located on Empire State Building?
It depends upon the time of day and what's happening at Empire. Channel 41, you know, Channel 41 is coming from 7 Times Square, or 4 Times Square, rather. ABC or Channel 7 sometimes will come from 4 Times Square when they're on standby. That's where the standby transmitter is. Channel 25, which is actually Channel 24, is on 4 Times Square. You'll notice now there's a channel 45. You may not be able to pick it up. It's low power. It's WLNY's. They're coming from the Trump Building on the east side. And there's a couple more.
Yeah, 45, is that RF channel or branding? There's also a 42, Daystar, which is really on channel 22, real. 45 LNY, I think you said Trump Tower. Is that true?
Yeah, that's coming from the Trump Tower. And what else? There's another one somewhere. I think it's on top of that was the standby on top of the news building, which is channel 11.
11 branding is from what location again?
42nd Street and Lexington Avenue. That's the standby. That was the standby. I don't know if it still is.
What's the approximate address of Trump Tower? I should know that, but I don't.
Yeah, it's the Trump apartment building. You know, I think I'm going to reset the repeater's controller. There's something weird going on.
Understand. Is Trump Tower a structure in Manhattan, Eric? And how high is it?
It's on the east side. I think it's on York Avenue or First Avenue. I forget. It's one of his new buildings up in the 80s.
Interesting. That's a, 1 kilowatt low power station?
Yeah, that's correct. It's on 45. They also have another one that's east of you. And I forget what frequency it's on.
Is that 67 or 68 branding? Which, the use of
55.
Okay, 55 is a strong station to me most of the time, even though it's off the back of my Yagi. And I think they're really on something like 54.
Yeah. There's 31 actually comes out of New Jersey.
Yeah, I get a beautiful 31 and all of its dash numbers. Also 50 and all of its dash numbers are from New Jersey, and I get them very well here. Surprisingly, Channel 2 branding, which also has an equal station, I think, from Hartford, gives me a fair amount of grief because I'm high enough up that Hartford comes roaring through one of the side lobes of my rooftop antenna. Back to you, Eric.
That's weird. The thing is, I think it's not beeping. You know, there's the CBS antenna, and now there's, we went through the antenna discussion on Empire, so, you know, not everything's coming out of the same antenna. Channel 5 is on a different antenna than channel 2 is, which is on a different antenna than channel 11, 7, and 13. We're all sharing the same antenna, and, you know, it's VHF as opposed to UHF.
Are you at all concerned with these antennas having a different amount of tilt-down angle as a function of what frequency they're fed into the same antenna?
No, all the antennas are designed with anywhere from a half a degree to 1 degree of downward tilt.
And that downward tilt does not change as a function of frequency. That's a good trick when you're doing antenna design. Doable, but you got to work extra hard to make that happen. You have to have an all-fed array, a corporate feeding system that is not at all serial, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, well, think about all the money that RCA put into that, and ODEB, what the hell is ODEB's last name? He was the designer of most of those antennas for many, many years. He left RCA and went up to Dielectric, who is one of the biggest suppliers, and most of his stuff, he was the president of Dielectric, and then they kind of pushed him out, and I think he's now a consultant for ERI.
At one time, you were concerned that some of the fill antennas from Empire were only doing a partial job. Which channel was that, and is that condition somewhat corrected now? Eric, go ahead.
Yeah, well, the fill antenna is still there. They still use it, and it still makes channel 2, and most of the U's, let's see, 2 and 9, I think. Who else is on it? One more. 2, 9, yeah, and 28. They're all on that. And the backfill antenna, which is aimed at Brooklyn, creates a zone of intersymbol distortion, and they ignore it.
So I think you're saying the people in Brooklyn are getting more problems, or the people out on the horizon are getting more problems?
People in Brooklyn are getting a nice strong signal from the backfill antenna, but as you get a little further away and the radiation disperses from them, there's areas where they cross over and create intersymbol distortion. And South Shore, Long Island has lots of issues with it.
So I think you're saying there's a particular range where you're getting the backfill plus the forward antenna of almost equal amplitude, but different. I think you're saying different time domain, and therefore a kind of intersymbol distortion, even though the co-channel on the exact same frequency channel.
Yeah, the reason for that is a different cable length between the antennas. It's supposed to be the same, but I've made measurements, and a few other people have, when they turn the backfill antenna off when they're doing work, and all of a sudden the equalizers go from going completely nuts to being perfectly calm.
And I'm not convinced that kind of co-channel from forward, from backfill and main antenna, that particular situation occurs at a particular azimuth setting from the customer's point of view. Therefore, a rotatable antenna might not be able to correct that. What do you think?
Yeah, depends where you are, because it does fall off as you get further away from it. There's an area where you could swing your antenna around, completely around, and, you know, good luck.
As I swing the antenna, though, there may still be some help here, because although you're getting lobes all over the place, some of those lobes on a conventional antenna could be tilted in elevation a little bit differently. And I guess there's a slim chance that would help. Or is it? Now, I'm beginning to think that the backfill and main antenna on Empire are not different enough in altitude that in elevation difference in angle, I can resolve that at my range. I may not be able to make an improvement there. Then again, the multipath of those could be a little bit different. As usual, I think there's a majority of time when you're going to get some benefit out of a rotator. I'm beginning to think the majority of serious television watchers must be using a rotator. One very nice thing that's happening with our new digital television is that when you're getting interference from front-end overload from a ham radio operator, you're not going to hear his audio, you're not going to see his modulation, the picture just disappears. And the client, the television watcher, will not know where it's coming from, therefore we're much less likely to be blamed. You might have some opinion on that one, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
All right, K2RIW, K2J. Let me just point out one thing. The backfill antenna is between the 81st and the 83rd floor on the side of the building. The main antenna is on the mooring mast, so there's probably about 400 or 500 feet in altitude difference between the two. The pattern for the backfill antenna kind of really aimed at Brooklyn, so where you are, I think it's going to have zero effect. So, but the interesting thing is where I am in Plainview, when we were making measurements, it definitely has an effect.
Yeah, I believe you. The way angular resolution works, 92 feet per mile is 1 degree. So if the two antennas were separated by 92 feet and I was 1 mile away, that would be 1 degree of difference in apparent point of origin from my point of view. 400 feet is going to be about 4 miles. 4 miles is only going to be 1 degree. I'm 30 miles, therefore I'm going to be getting a little bit more than a tenth of a degree of difference between those two antennas from IQTH. Under normal circumstances, I cannot resolve that. But the way multipath behaves, I can see how one signal versus the other might behave differently, and therefore a rotator is going to help. You're, what, 25 miles from Empire when you're at Plainview, and you did see a benefit when watching Channel 4 as you rotated the antenna, how hard your converter has to work. Is that approximately true, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
Yeah, well, I see a big difference in how I can actually send you the file for the pictures of the differences between the taps of the equalizers poking off and when the backfill antenna is on, when the backfill antenna is off. So it's very visible. But, you know, as we get to the newer technology receivers, the fifth generation equalizers, it seems, you know, that kind of stuff gets bothered less and less. If you get a third generation equalizer, you usually have a lot of trouble. The newer equalizers also allow for distributed television broadcasting, which actually is an experiment in New York that was going on where they had a bunch of, Channel 31, they had a bunch of small low-power transmitters strategically placed around the city to try and improve reception, where they all run synchronously with each other, but that doesn't guarantee that the symbols line up exactly in phase with each other no matter where you are. It's just a matter of which one's stronger.
As you go to higher generation converters with better equalizers built in, do you envision substantial improvement in the next couple of years, Eric, or do you think the technology has already extracted most of what is available? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
Well, no, the improvements are still coming down the line, especially now with the addition. You don't realize that some of the stations are now transmitting ESB, which is enhanced 8VSB, which is for mobile reception, which actually works quite well. If you actually analyze some of the streams, you'll find that there's some PIDs that are allocated for that. And Channel 55 is ready to, they've got a Rhodes and Schwartz transmitter up there. They're going to start experimenting with mobile DTV transmission. And I'm not sure I actually have to look. ABC is supposed to do that. And I think that's it at the moment.
Yeah, there's my next question. Have any of the stations to date transmitted this, I think it's called ESB, mobile type transmission, which is less than 8VSB. Have any of them done it? Maybe yes, maybe no. And how many of the stations in the near future are likely to do it? I think you're saying Channel 55 is one of them, and Channel 7 is maybe another. Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, in Washington and Virginia, I think there's like 4 or 5 stations doing it now, and there's a few other places in the country where they're actively transmitting it, and it's gone beyond the testing stage. But from the economic standpoint, it's interesting because Qualcomm, which has Flow TV, they want to sell it because they're losing their shirts real fast.
Okay. Qualcomm is the creator, and they've got the patent, and are they selling rights to it? Is that what you're saying? Or are they a equipment producer that they're selling? Run that by again, Eric. Go ahead.
Qualcomm has a different system. It's called Flow TV. It's not EVSB. They went and bought up all the Channel 55s all across the country for a couple million bucks apiece. Was it about 3 years ago? And they, in essence, have this mobile TV service that is on, I think it's shared with Verizon phones, with VCAP, And also they have their product, which is called Flow TV. You can buy anywhere, which just type in Flow TV in your Google and you'll find out what it's all about.
Will there be a significant number of cell phone-like things, iPhone 4-like things, that will be giving me this service in the near future in the New York City area? Is that possibly coming down to us? Eric, go ahead.
Oh, it's available now. You've got VCast, you've got Flow TV. There was another operator that set themselves up, but they kind of went broke. So, but it's very big in South America, and this is one way. This is, you know, everything is sort of like cable on your iPhone, if you want, cable on your telephone. It's not actually on the iPhone, it's on some other phones.
All kinds of technology. Okay, let's go back.
I'm going to reset the thing. Stand by a second.
Alrighty, and then I'm going to pick up with Joe if Joe is available. But you reset the machine first. You set the machine first. Go ahead, Eric.
Clock not set. Ready.
Hang on for another minute, Dick.
Welcome.
Roger. Multi-kilowatt
transformer running at 60 hertz being fed by something like a 440 line from the street. And that particular transformer was manufactured in the year one, so to speak, and it was producing an extremely strong magnetic field, so that people who were doing television monitoring, who were doing television composing and things like that, were getting dancing images on the screen. So that shielding from that is an extremely difficult thing to do. New metal can sort of do it, but ordinary electrostatic thick pieces of copper with finger stock and whatever, you'd be amazed how poor the shielding would be to get rid of a very strong 60-cycle magnetic field. WQRYY, KQRIW on the TechNet.
Okay, that was the only question they had. And I got another DX TV station on low band.
Which one are you watching and where is it coming from?
I didn't say I got it today, but I did say I got it. WOI from Cedar, I believe it's Cedar Rapids, Iowa, on RF Channel 5.
RF Channel 5, how about that? Cedar Rapids, Iowa. That's what, 1,500 miles at least?
I would probably guess it's somewhere around that vicinity, but that's pretty good. So I got a couple of different ones on low band. They're out there.
When you were getting WOI in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, which I think is closer to 1,100 miles, probably 1,000 miles airline, for what length of time was that signal coming in, and what day was that, if you happen to know?
I believe it was about a week ago, and the signal was not there for very long. I think it was fairly hot last Sunday. Either Saturday, I believe it was Sunday. It was fairly hot on Sunday, so it didn't last for very long. It seemed like that was one of these things where it was more of a like a mid-morning type of thing. The thing just popped in there, and then just as the heat became more prevalent out here, it disappeared pretty quickly.
Yeah, I think Channel 5 is somewhere around 70 megacycles. Did you find that by scanning with something like a ICOM R7000 receiver, or did you do that with scanning with your actual digital converter itself? Back to you, Joe.
I don't use the converter in the scan function. I have a different converter than you have, so it does different things. I don't auto-scan because I don't want to lose all my stuff in New York, because it will absolutely do that, and everything else I have in there. Easy add works pretty good, but I left it on RF channel 5. I can leave it there indefinitely. And when something comes on, it'll just simply tell, it'll display a picture, or at least give me some header information as far as what was there at one time, even if I missed the picture.
Okay, now, one of the things that I think you've told me in the past that I'd like you to run by one more time, and that is, a person who is very familiar with television broadcast, Advanced Television Selection Committee, ATSC, digital television, told me that the pilot frequency of being transmitted on adjacent channels must be within 3 hertz, the two different pilots. And I think you've told me that when you're getting co-channel interference, there are times when you've seen a considerably more than 3 hertz of difference of the pilot tone. What's the biggest amount of difference you've seen in pilot tones? And according to this buddy of mine, who seems to be quite informed about broadcast, he says that the rules are they can't be more than 3 hertz differential between adjacent channels. WQRYY, KQRIW.
Between adjacent channels or co-channel? I would only be able to hear something co-channel. I have detected, I believe, pitches on these things as high as 250 hertz, 220, 250 hertz, somewhere around there. But most of them are very close to each other. They're well within 10 hertz of from one to the other.
Yeah, in parts per million of accuracy, that sounds reasonable. But this requirement for 3 hertz, he said adjacent channels. And so, we no longer have dead channels in between, if you know what I mean. And so he really might mean that error in the required frequency can't be between adjacent channels more than 3. Yes, you don't get the opportunity to beat them against each other with normal equipment. And so you measured it on co-channels, 250 hertz. I knew it was an audio tone. he told me that no, it can't be more than 3 hertz. So I have to go back to that guy, and you've got hard measurements, and I believe it. Okay, the next person who signed in was Les, K2TGW. I hope all this jazz hasn't put you to sleep, Les. And what would you like to talk about tonight? K2TGW, K2LIW in the second half.
Here on this, what you were just talking about?
Yeah, let me pick up Les first. Is Les there? Okay, we got Les and John in that order, but you said you got some further information on that, Joe, and then we'll pick up with Wesley on that in that order. Joe, go right ahead with your further info.
Using a service monitor from work in Queens, I have measured a multiple of these, a multitude of these channels, and most of them are seem to be like dot 309441 or whatever the hell it is. You know, I could go down to like 1 hertz resolution on the service monitor I'm using, which is Motorola service monitor. But about maybe 6 or 7 transmitters out of New York are all the same frequency, the same exact frequency from one to the other. There are a few others that are not on the same frequency. So if you're telling me that they've all got to be within 3 hertz, now if you're telling me as far as adjacent channel, they got to be within 3 hertz of like channel 24 to 25, I'll re-measure that again tomorrow or Tuesday, and I'll come up with some hard data for you and tell you if that's what I see or not.
Yeah, I think he's saying that 3 hertz between adjacent channels is required so that the adjacent channels don't create a kind of co-channel interference. The advantage with the digital system is that you don't have to have dead channels in between like we used to have. The bad news is that now the adjacent channels from the same locale have to be within 3 hertz of each other. And I guess there's some kind of a orthogonality taking place by which the converter can, in digital processing, remove the adjacent channel, even though this RF strength could be significant into the front end. Wesley, and to XJN, go right ahead with your question or comment on this, K2RIW.
Actually, I had a question in different areas, so I'm not going to interrupt you. I'm just going to wait for my question.
Very fine. Okay, Les apparently is not available. Joe is next, KC2WGB. Go right ahead with your question or comment, John, K2RIW on the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Good evening, Dick, and everybody on the net. Simple question. Back in the dark ages, when we had recurrent sweep scopes and the initial triggered sweep scopes, we used to be able to buy a multiplex switch to convert from single channel vertical input to dual channel. I'm looking to do the same thing with two spectrum analyzers on the X and Y outputs into a single monitor. Do you know if anything like that is available or being used? I know it may have to be a triggered system, but have you ever heard of anything like that being done?
Yeah, I've used some of those scopes that had the switching device, which allowed you to displace two separate signals and display two separate signals across the screen. Even though it's a one-channel scope, you've got a two-channel display with that switching device. And it was time-sharing. And you could set it up in at least two different modes to switch back and forth very slowly in between alternate sweeps, or to switch back and forth very rapidly. And there's advantages and disadvantages of each way of doing that. Synchronizing sometimes becomes a little bit spooky. Now, in the case of a spectrum analyzer, to do a switching function, I think you're saying you're not doing the switching function in the front RF end of the spectrum analyzer. You make it sound like you're only doing it on the display, and you're going to do a separate switch between X and Y. Give me a couple more words on that one. I'm not quite sure what you're trying to do on this one, John. You got it, John. K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. Yes, the two spectrum analyzers, I'm going to take the output that's available at the X and Y and put those into a monitor. But my monitor only has one input, and it's a Tektronix 10-inch monitor. I want to be able to look at both waveforms on that monitor. So I need some kind of a matrix switch, and I was just wondering if you have seen anything like that. I'm just switching the output.
And when you're doing that, are the two horizontal sweeps of the two separate spectrum analyzers, are they going to be synchronized? John, go ahead.
No, they will not.
Okay. Wow.
saying you want to switch to spectrum analyzer number one while its X sweep and its Y sweep fills up the screen with information. Then you're going to switch over to spectrum analyzer number two while its X sweep and its Y sweep fixes up, gives at least one display on the screen. And there are times when you switch between the two, you're going to be catching the dead time, the retrace time of the other spectrum analyzer. Many spectrum analyzers have an external sweep function by which you can take the sweep output from analyzer number one and use it to sweep spectrum analyzer number two, therefore force them into synchronization. That's going to make life a lot simpler. You're trying to do a double pole, double throw switching function here. In other words, the common port of two separate double pole, double throw switches, double pole, single throw switches, the common port of one's going to go to X, the common port of the other's going to go to Y. So there's a total of four inputs to this switching matrix network. And is video storage involved? Because some of the modern day spectrum analyzers do storage as opposed to live display. So as you can see, life's going to get a little bit complicated. To find a matrix switching function to handle the switching speeds in the dynamic range, that's easy. I mean, your sweep is rarely beyond 60 sweeps per second, usually quite a bit slower. Your vertical deflection is not very high speed data most of the time. So simple matrixing devices intended for digital function could possibly do this for you, as long as they've got enough peak to valley voltage capability. But the timing could get a bit spooky.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
As you can see, I'm a little bit afraid that when you switch from analyzer number one to analyzer number two, you're going to catch analyzer number two during its retrace time. So I think you're way ahead of the game if you force them to be horizontally synchronized, Les. Correction, John. Back to you, John. K2RIW.
Okay, I just thought you might have known of something readily available. I'm going to try to do it, and I'll let you guys know how I make out. Sounds like I have my work cut out for me. Thank you very much for the information.
Yeah, you would like the switching function to be nice and fast, so there's not dead time between the two. That's easy. To get switching devices that work in microseconds is easy. The horizontal sweep function is probably something in the vicinity of 0 to 5 volts or whatever. To make a switching device, a FET switch, cover 5 volts, I think is relatively easy. Some of them do, some of them do not. And the vertical deflection might be somewhat similar, something like 5 volts. So peak-to-valley voltage capability of the switching device is one function. Isolation, on-off isolation between them, is another function. Dead time. I think you can meet all that. But you don't have a total time display now. In other words, half the display is going to be each of those two different traces. Therefore, those traces are going to be dimmer on the screen. And maybe by turning up the brightness and darkening the lights in the room, they can compensate for that. I sense what you're trying to do is to display two separate spectrums that you're comparing, that they're closely related to each other, and you want to compare the two spectrums. Maybe one of them you're tuning to try to make it better than the other. Let me drop. And I've seen fancy spectrum analyzers that will display two functions on the screen and lay them on top of each other. I'll admit that they're expensive instruments. Okay, fascinating project. Let us know as the developments work on that one, John. Back to you, John, K2RIW.
Oh, yes, Dick, I sure will. I don't mean to say that I'm going to try to overlay them to compare them. I'm just going to have one above the other. And the idea is the HP analyzers, as you know, they're very wide, and both of the screens are on the left-hand side, so no matter if I vertically stack them or horizontally, I can't really look at both displays at the exact same time. And my monitor can record for 10 hours and play back, so I may be able to work something around with that. But thank you very much for your input.
When you say they're both displaying on the left-hand side, I'm not sure I know what that means, John. Go ahead.
I'm sorry, Dick, I didn't make it clear. The view between screens, the CRTs, are both located on the left-hand side of a unit that's about 24 inches wide. So the screens are separated by, I could maybe catch one in the right eye and one in the left eye, you know what I'm saying, but I can't really see them both at the same time.
You know, John, there's another approach here. Video cameras these days are getting so cheap. Your 2U cams and whatever are getting so inexpensive. To have two video cameras aimed at the two screens and then combine them in various ways to bring them over to a single display screen, and while you're at it, change the colors, make one red and one blue when you superimpose them. Have you considered an optical combining technique as opposed to an electronic combining technique and leave the individual screens alone? Now all the timing errors, all of that goes away. All the timing and synchronization, all of that disappears. Now back to you, John.
Dick, that is an excellent idea. No, I did not think of that. In fact, I do have a video switcher that can do that exact function, and I might be able to put that on an even larger screen. With my vision, I could use it. But I will pursue that effort, too. That is a very good idea. Thank you very much. Back to you, Dick.
Question in this area.
Yeah, Wesley, I'm going to get back to you in a second. You'd be amazed how many times I've had an extremely elaborate display. Like, for instance, a sampling oscilloscope that's capable of going to 22 gigahertz. I was looking at quarter of a nanosecond events pulsing. I was pulsing at 10 gigahertz in a great big chamber, filling up the screen with a whole bunch of red dots and green dots, which had a particular pattern to them, a particular cluster to the pattern, to try to take all those dots on that screen of that very fancy Hewlett-Packard, what was it called now, 1920? Can't remember the model number of this sampling oscilloscope mainframe with sampling heads in front of it, and we're sampling these extremely brief pulsing events. I simply put a reasonably high-resolution video camera aimed at that screen. It did a simple, in those days, tape recording. This was back in 1995. This was at Edwards Air Force Base in their great big anechoic chamber. I just put a video camera on it and recorded the, in a camcorder-like thing, in a cassette, recorded the data and played it back on a large screen to an audience. And at first it sounds like it was a low-resolution display. To try to take those 3 million blinking dots that were on that screen. Each dot was being painted on the screen for 3 seconds and then winked out. And they were being painted on at a million per second. To try to make any kind of a display capture that really electronically with the X and Y axis and the Z axis of that scope, out of the question. But to simply put a high resolution color camcorder on that did a beautiful job. So doing it in video might make life a lot simpler. N2XJN, K2RIW. Go ahead, Wesley.
One more thing?
Yeah, go ahead, John.
If we have time, I have a second question, but you can wait till next week, but just write it down, so if you do have time, I would like to ask one more question later on after everybody's done.
Yeah, we got some questions of Wesley, and then you're next after that. Go ahead, Wesley.
Yeah, I have a little comment to the John's problem. See, the thing is that there is a device being called switch, which is switching the camera. There is another device that is being called multiplexer. What it does is actually divide the screen on four. So you have a TV screen, and then you take the picture from two cameras. Now you have a picture, one next to the other. There was a device fairly cheap that could be acquired in the Radio Shack, not any longer, I believe. That divides the picture on two, not on four. So that could be utilized in this area. But the question of mine is, remember in the old TVs when you were trying to actually videotape that picture, you get something like a moving light, I don't know if the wording would be the proper interlacing, and the quality of that was actually bad. And the question of mine is, wouldn't that happen if you try to use the camera in order to get the picture from CRT? But do you?
In the case of a color picture being painted on the screen, at something like 59 and a fraction fields per second, or is it frames per second? I can't remember which one it is, but it's slightly different from the 60 cycles. And they made it different from the 60 cycles. They made it as close to 60 cycles as possible so you wouldn't see hum bars moving across the screen.
If it was different, the visible number of frames is 20 frames per second, and when it's lower you can see that. And then if you multiply that, then 24 and 24 is actually 48, close to 50 cycles, and close to the frequency of the line power gland appears.
Are you saying, Wesley, that the error you were getting was a kind of a stroboscopic effect between the recording system and the displaying system? Go ahead.
That is correct. You didn't notice that in the old times. You were trying to videotape that and you see like a line, like the picture is not locked and it's moving up and down. It wasn't moving. It's just on your tape was moving to this.
In this tape recording of the Hewlett-Packard sampling oscilloscope, I didn't have that problem because what was being displayed on the screen was not at a frame rate or a field rate. It was painting dots on the screen that fell into a particular pattern, and it was painting a million dots per second. Each dot stayed on the screen for exactly 3 seconds, and then each dot winked out. So it was a sampling oscilloscope display of synchronized pulsing events, where the pulsing was being synchronized, but the RF signal within the pulses was not being synchronized.
Yes, but he's got two special analyzers with the TRTs, the monochrome and the delta, I believe, taking lines. Correct me if I'm wrong.
The good news on his spectrum analyzer is he's got complete freedom to change the horizontal sweep rate. He can make that horizontal sweep rate either synchronous or very non-synchronous with the frame rate of his television camera. So although he may have some problems at certain sweep rates, he's got enough knobs on the front panel of the spectrum analyzer, I think he can control his way out of that. Back to you, Wesley.
That is a good idea, I think, as always.
Okay, you said now you had another question you wanted to ask if we had some time. You got it.
The question of mine is in regards to the impedance, because that wasn't covered with the previous answer. You have a 20 inches of the variable cable, and you want to find out that 50 ohm impedance. You want to see this 50 ohm impedance on your meter, and in my particular situation, it would be the Schwarzbacher, which actually has two of them. Has the ability to see the phase and the gain, and has the ability to measure the impedance and show the graph on it. Then, if you are able to do that, now you have a bunch of connectors and you want to find which one is the 50 ohm load and which one is the short one. Because when you look at them and you don't have a marking, you're not able to say that. Back to you.
If I had a set of terminating devices, some of them are shorted, some of them are open, and some of them are 50 ohms, the quickest way to find out who is who would be to connect an ohm meter between semiconductor and shield of each of those devices. Your ohm meter will show you that very fast. But now, if you made the mistake of making your test cable 70 ohms instead of 50 ohms, and you went through the calibration procedure normalizing to the end of the cable with a 50 ohm termination, a short, and an open, believe it or not, the spectrum analyzer, the network analyzer, the vector network analyzer, with its 12-point calibration procedure, would completely remove all of the crazy effects of your 70 ohm test cable. Ain't that something? But now if I've got a mysterious piece of cable, and I want to really know what its impedance is, and I'm connecting it to a well-calibrated vector network analyzer, where at the end of the cable, I've normalized everything to short, open, and 50 ohms. If I then take my mysterious piece of cable and terminate it with 70 ohms, at the far end of the new cable, and at the input end of the new cable, I connect it to my vector network analyzer, and as I sweep through a wide enough frequency region, if it was a 50-ohm cable, I'll measure 50 ohms continuously. If it was a 70-ohm cable, and it terminated with 50 ohms on the far end, I will see an impedance that swings between something like 37 ohms and something like 100 ohms as I sweep through those frequencies where the cable is a quarter wavelength long and then a half wavelength long. When the mysterious cable, let me drop. When the mysterious cable is a quarter wavelength long, depending what you put on the far end of the cable and what you measure on the near end of the cable, one is inverse of the other. It's called a frequency, it's a termination inversion device. The best example I could give would be if I had a 50-ohm cable and I connected a 100-ohm load to it. That's a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. When the cable, the unknown cable, which is really 50 ohms, and I've really terminated it with 100 ohms, when that cable is some number of half wavelengths long, it repeats impedance, and if it was low in loss, I would measure 100 ohms at the input. When it's a quarter wavelength long, or an odd number of quarter wavelengths long, because I've got this 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, 50 ohm cable, 100 ohm impedance, I'll again see a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, but on the other side, I'll measure 25 ohms on the input. So, with a 50-ohm cable and a 100-ohm termination, when I sweep, I will sweep it. I will see it sweep between 25 and 100 ohms. So, whenever you've got an unknown piece of cable, you can do two things. You can either find the termination. That means that there's no impedance change as you sweep in frequency. That's one approach. Or the other approach is you put a known termination, like 50 or 100 on it, measure the peak and valley of what you see on the input end. With a little bit of mathematics, you'll figure out exactly what the impedance of your cable was. Wonder if that makes some sense, Wesley. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I understand that, but one thing that I do not understand. What you said, at least what I understand, as you said, maybe you didn't say that, is that if I take the ohm meter and I put that ohm meter to the connector that I do not know if it's short or if it's 50 ohm, it should show me 50 ohm. That almost impossible, but to you.
Okay, you've got a series of terminating devices, which are usually about an inch long or less, three of them at least, a short, an open, and a termination, that are used in your calibration kit to calibrate your vector network analyzer and its testing cable. Those are the terminating devices. Those terminating devices, if somebody wiped off the labels on them, your ohm meter will easily show you which one is which. The short, the open, and the 50 ohms, you'll find that immediately with an ohm meter. I'll admit you cannot use an ohm meter on a piece of coaxial cable. The piece of coaxial cable only has an impedance, so to speak, when you're using it at RF frequencies, and you see the effects of its impedance when you sweep through a series of RF frequencies. So by putting your 50 ohm termination on the end of an unknown piece of cable and sweeping that piece of cable through a frequency region on your vector network analyzer, with a little bit of mathematics, it'll tell you exactly what the impedance of that cable was. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I understand that. But the question then is, I know that when I put ohm meter on the open connector, I'm going to have it open. When I put it on a short, I'm going to have it close to short. When I put it on 50 ohm, what am I going to get? Close to short, it's not going to show 50 ohm. It is not the resistor in effect.
A well-made 50 ohm termination, which is part of a calibration kit, is 50 ohms DC to light. It is 50 ohms at zero frequency, which is your ohm meter. It is 50 ohms at 1 kilohertz. It's 50 ohms at 100 kilohertz. It's 50 ohms at a megacycle. It's 50 ohms at 100 megacycles. It's 50 ohms at 1,000 megacycles. A well-made termination used for calibration is 50 ohms at every reasonable frequency. You're going to test it at. And